The Daily Buzz from the 2014 Sundance Film Festival is sponsored in part by Soyombo Mongolian Vodka, crafted in small batches at the original distillery site of the last emperor's palace in Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia. Online at mongolianvodkas.com/soyombo. The Daily Buzz on KCPW is sponsored in part by Sabra Hummus. Inspired by flavors from around the globe, Sabra's dips are handmade from fresh ingredients and spices. Sabra's mission is to bring healthy Middle Eastern cuisine to people's everyday diets. Online at sabra.com.
This is the Daily Buzz at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Eugene Hernandez at the 1 million square foot lounge here on Main Street. On today's show, filmmakers Jesse Moss from The Overnighters, Joe Berlinger, who directed a new documentary called Whitey about Whitey Bulger, as well as Rick Perez, director of Caesar's Last Fast. They'll all be here talking about their new films playing at Sundance. Coming up in a moment, we'll have our Hot Topics roundtable with Kim Voynar from Movie City News, Nigel Smith from IndieWire, and my colleague Brian Brooks from the Film Society. And later in the show, Ira Deutschman from Emerging Pictures and Columbia University will be here to talk about his unique relationship with this festival dating back to 1989. That's all coming up after the news from the BBC. And we're back here at the Million Square Foot Lounge on Main Street for the Daily Buzz, our daily program here at Sundance 2014, looking at the films and all of the buzz happening at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Presented by the Film Society of Lincoln Center with our producer Irene Cho, the show is supported by Soyombo Vodka. And as we kick off this second edition of the Daily Buzz, 2014 Sundance Film Festival, we start our show with our Hot Topics segment, usually gathering together an eclectic mix of journalists. My co-host for this segment is my colleague at the Film Society, Brian Brooks.
Hello.
And excited to have seated at the table here at the Microsoft Lounge, Mr. Nigel Smith, managing editor of IndieWire.
Thanks for having me.
And Ms. Kim Voynar
from
Movie City News.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about Sundance. Let me start with a sort of general question to kind of get the group going and sort of see where you guys take this. Why does Sundance matter? Ooh. Why is Sundance important to us as a festival? Why is it, in your capacity and as journalists, in what you do, why Sundance?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's interesting, you know, just having gone into what maybe some people in who really watch this stuff in award season. We're going into phase two now that we have yesterday's nominations. But in a certain way, I will say that I would even throw it out there that Sundance is a beginning for next year's awards.
Yeah.
Because there will most definitely be films that we will speculate are going to pop out. And some of these, like Fruitvale Station last year, which was one which didn't get a nomination, but which was to the chagrin of a lot of people, but still did quite well. And there's other films, though, that did, such as like The Square. I'm sure I'm missing probably, Cutie and the Boxer, which was actually mentioned yesterday in the press
20
conference.
Feet from Stardom, which opened the festival last year.
And Dirty Wars also got a nomination.
Dirty Wars.
It's funny, last night there were there were folks tweeting about one of the films, I think it was Whiplash, and someone tweeted that one of the actors from the film is going to be a supporting actor nominee next year.
Yeah, J.K. Simmons.
And there was already a backlash saying folks at Sundance are already talking about Oscar nominations next year.
Well, hey, that happened with The Sessions, though, and there was a lot of buzz coming off of that movie for
Helen Hunt.
Yeah,
and John Hawks.
And both of them. Oh no, Helen Hunt did land a nomination in the end. So sometimes the buzz is warranted.
I don't know, Kim, what do you think? I mean, the fact that people are already prognosticating next year's awards the first day of Sundance.
Oh, no, we would never.
But the fact that we're even talking about it. I don't know. Why is Sundance important to you?
I think, you know, Sundance for me, Toronto is a big sales fest, and it's obviously an important fest, but for me, Sundance is where I tend to see films that surprise me more. you never know what you're going to get, but when you do get something really big, like I remember seeing Beast of the Southern Wild here and just being so completely blown away, and you knew when you saw that film you had seen something completely special and completely amazing, and something popping at Sundance like that is really important. Martha Marcy May Marlene.
Martha Marcy May Marlene.
You know, films like that that, you know,
it
you
can be a huge, it can be a major launch pad.
Well,
and,
yeah.
and I say Martha Marcy May Marlene in particular because for me that's a film that outside of a place like Sundance might not have popped. You know, it's a very artsy film, and you get it to a place like Sundance and you get that buzz going and all of a sudden it's the next big thing.
And that's the, I mean, that's the one thing about Sundance is that these are the films that we are going to be seeing throughout the year.
Yeah, right.
Even if they're not even awards contenders per se, they are the films that are going to be going to other festivals, and many of these films are going to be having theatrical distribution, and this is like the plot.
And if we could make that point too, I think it's important to make that point that a film popping and being an awards contender is not necessarily the end all be all, right? There's a lot of important, good artistic films that come out of a fest like Sundance, and whether they go on to be an Oscar nominee or not is not necessarily relevant to me. It's keeping artistic film alive and happening, and Sundance facilitates that.
And as someone was talking yesterday, I can't remember where, it might have been at the IndieWire party that you guys hosted.
The Chili
night.
Party.
The Chili Party.
Hosted by none other than Rose McGowan.
But someone was talking, Rose McGowan was there, but someone was talking about how, you know, the way the distribution is even happening has changed, and in some ways has opened up options for filmmakers beyond the theatrical, which of course a lot of people come here and they want that nice theatrical buy and be distributed and be seen, and of course that's a great thing to have, but there are so many other options now with digital distribution.
And the climate is changing on that.
And the Sundance Institute, and yesterday they had their opening press conference, touted that, how they were helped through their artist services program, have been trying to be a conduit for distribution through these other methods that are outside of theatrical.
Well, and we're opening Sundance on the heels of the announcement of Ted Hope coming on as CEO of Fandor.
Right.
He's at Sundance this year, but I'm really watching to see what he's going to do with that as a distribution mechanism. I know he's a huge supporter of indie film, and he's looking for ways to support filmmakers and to keep film alive. So a lot of promising things on the horizon for indie film, I think.
Switching gears, we're heading into the first weekend of the festival. So, you know, Saturday, Sunday of the festival, of the first weekend, they're usually packed, obviously, with films that folks are anxious about. So let me just get a sense from the group. What are you looking forward to this weekend, tomorrow, Sunday, going into the first few days of the festival? What has piqued your interest? What are you hearing good things about? I'm also asking you this question for those listening at home. They may want to pop up here for the holiday weekend and check out some movies. So what do you think? What looks interesting to you?
Well, I was going to say just one thing that was interesting is tonight is going to be the Salt Lake City Gala of MITT, the documentary about Republican nominee for President Mitt Romney. And actually it was kind of interesting because I won't be there because I'm going to be up here, but I am kind of curious now to see it because only the fact that I ran into a friend who told me that he was at the grocery store, which I always call Albertsons, but it's called something else.
It's like Fresh Market. But it looks exactly like the Albertsons.
Inside, but I still call it Albertsons. Anyway, apparently Mitt Romney was there.
I heard
like
that.
Shopping, and I'm like, who knew that Mitt Romney went to the grocery
does his own
store?
Shopping.
You know? I mean, suddenly I was interested in seeing this movie because. And because I also heard, you know, it really gives an inside look, and like, he actually did look surprised when he didn't win the election. And it has it on. I mean, this is what I heard. I haven't seen, so I don't. Obviously, I haven't seen it, but this is what I hear is some of the inside of the movie, which might be a little bit intriguing for people who might have a little politico intrigue interest.
What's that column in, like, the tabloids, Just Like Us?
Mitt Romney, he's just like us. Sundance is the great equalizer everybody has to get their food at the market.
Nigel, what are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to this film called Hellion. It's screening today.
Right on, yeah.
And it stars Aaron Paul in his first performance that I'm going to see post Breaking Bad. He also stars in an upcoming blockbuster that doesn't look really promising. But this, I've heard really good things about this film. It stars this new coming actor. I'm excited for that. And also Camp X-Ray. There's a lot of buzz surrounding that film. It's Kristen Stewart's new vehicle. Mm-hmm. And all eyes are going to be on her today at the Eccles to see whether she does a good job as a Guantanamo officer who develops a friendship with one of the detainees.
It's hard to talk about the competition films at Sundance today without talking about the notable actor or actors that appear in them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's basically a given at this point. I remember back in the old days, not that long ago, when folks would talk about the competition and there'd be actually this kind of surprise or this kind of, it was a rare thing
right.
that a competition film had a celebrity. And when it did, it was almost sort of like frowned upon. Oh, that's the movie with, you know, mm-hmm. such and such film with a celebrity. Now it's pretty much a guarantee that a film in the competition will have a celebrity.
But not always. I mean, like Another Earth with Britt Marling was, I mean,
yeah.
she popped huge with that
yeah,
film at Sundance.
Films, yeah.
And that was not really on anybody's radar until yeah. after we saw that film. And then all of a sudden she was the talk of that fest, right? So that can still happen.
Yeah, and so that's what I wanted to ask about is, and I think IndieWire had an article a couple days ago.
The 10 actors to watch
looking
out
at
for.
The actors to watch, actors yeah. who we might, you know. You're,
well, a lot of the competition titles don't necessarily that. Have big name star
actors. So who are some of the actors.
Actors
that you're watching or that you're anticipating might
oh,
be
geez,
the next?
You want names?
Where's your notes, Nigel?
I know. Well, I don't have the list on me, but hopefully by the end of the festival, I'll know them all by heart.
While he's looking at his notes, I just wanted to put in a thing about Hellion. Kat Candler, this film was developed off of her short film of the same name, which was one of my favorite shorts mm-hmm. of like, 2 years ago, I think?
Yeah.
So I'm curious to see that one because a lot of times when a short is expanded into a feature, it doesn't yeah. always play, and I've heard good things about this one.
In fairness, Nigel, John Wildman said yesterday that the most exciting people for him are the yeah. people he hasn't met yet.
Yeah.
He hasn't
right.
heard
that's,
of yet.
That's absolutely
same
true.
Goes for
I mean,
me.
One thing that was kind of along the lines that was interesting yesterday during the press conference, which had Robert Redford and Kerry Putnam was the head at Sundance
so
Institute.
The traditional opening
and John
day.
Cooper, the trio. But she kind of, Kerry Putnam actually addressed this a bit, and she said, you know, as studios and the indie world kind of, they're kind of separating in a sense because the studios are having to produce content that will be cross-cultural. And, you know, the independents still are doing stories that are original and, you know, things that they want to do. But
never.
But yet, you know, actors, she said, actually, we actually see a lot more named actors who want to be a part of that. And so mm-hmm. it's actually not that unusual to see, mm-hmm. you know, names such as people we're talking about here who are in these films, you know. Mm-hmm.
Which is great that actors that are more established are mm-hmm. still willing and interested in doing independent film
right.
and will do it for much less money than you would think because mm-hmm. they want to be involved in a project that's actually artistic yeah. and cool.
But in the 2 minutes we have left, the counter side of the flip side of that, the question to sort of follow up is to what extent does it disadvantage a film coming into the festival, maybe at a micro budget, that doesn't have a big mm-hmm. name actor? How do you draw attention at a festival? How do you draw attention in the marketplace mm-hmm. Without a big name?
It's true.
Or
well, because
mm-hmm.
it's not always about having a big name. It's about how well their film is done.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
it can be a small film on a micro budget that's really artfully edited and that pays attention mm-hmm. in post. And if it's well written and all those elements mm-hmm. are in place, it doesn't matter to me if it has an A-list celebrity.
Right.
It matters to me if the story is
right.
told well.
And again,
Fruitvale Station last year yeah. wasn't remembered because of Octavia Spencer.
No,
right?
No, no.
Michael B. Jordan no. was, you know, relatively unknown for those mm-hmm. not really familiar with Friday Night Lights, and he emerged as a total breakout mm-hmm. of the festival.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes for, you know, Elizabeth Olsen and Marcy May Marlene.
Yeah.
It just depends how
Beast
good
the
film
Wild.
Is and if it gains traction.
Beast was
and
years
Beast,
ago.
Which didn't
had,
even have actors
yeah.
like
yeah.
that. You know, the
unknowns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. The
oh, now you're stuck, aren't you?
I'm on her name.
the little girl from Beast of the Southern Wild.
Yes, Kevangene. Thank you.
Very
cool.
Thank
you,
Nigel.
See? He didn't even have his notes.
Oh. Well, her, I know. She's been nominated for an Oscar.
Well, now she's up there, but she wasn't before. She was just a feisty, fun personality.
So we'll see who pops out this
yeah,
year
exactly.
and who we're talking about this time next year at Sundance.
That's true.
Well, we'll let you get to it. The Daily Buzz here on KCPW. Coming to you from Main Street, and thrilled to have had at the table our co-host Brian Brooks, Nigel from IndieWire, Kim from Movie City News. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You.
Thank
Happy
you for
Friday.
Having us.
Thanks.
We'll be back in just a second. Day 2 of the Daily Buzz, Sundance Film Festival 2014, here on Main Street. And as we continue on the show, excited to have someone I've known for a while in a different capacity, Jesse Moss. Welcome.
Thank you.
We first worked together when I was at IndieWire. You used to write for IndieWire.
Yeah, I think you might have edited a few pieces.
I think
write.
I did more than one.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on having a movie at Sundance.
Very exciting.
It's called The Overnighters, and we only have about 8 minutes to speak, 7.5 now, as the countdown clock reminds me to my left here. So I'm just going to dive right in. For folks who are listening in here, and we're on KCPW here in Utah, and for those who might be listening outside as well, give us just a thumbnail sketch of what the movie's about, and then we'll talk more
sure.
about it.
Well, there's a huge oil boom in North Dakota. People may have heard about it. It's gotten some press, but they've discovered a giant lake of oil under North Dakota. And there's been a huge influx of men and machinery to extract that oil. Like tens of thousands of Americans have gone up there looking for work. And there's not much up in North Dakota. And what's happened is it's transformed life up there in these small towns. They've become boom towns, frontier towns. And my film is about a pastor in this boom town of Williston, North Dakota, who opens his church to let men who've come up to look for work sleep, because there's nowhere to sleep. All the oil companies have booked up the hotel rooms. Mm-hmm. So it's about the pastor's relationship with these desperate men who come to North Dakota looking to reinvent themselves.
And they are the overnighters.
They are the overnighters. That's what the program is called, the Overnighters Program. Mm-hmm. And he has something like 50 men and a few women sleeping in his church, in the pews, in the parking lot. And that little community, a representation of America in a thumbnail, is what the film's about.
There are certainly any number of ways you could have approached this story. It's an incredible story. There's so many different angles, obviously. Tell us about how you found out about this, and specifically how and why you decided to focus on this program, this overnighter program.
Yeah, so there's a lot of fear and distrust in the community, this little small town of Williston, about the influx of people coming. They brought crime, they've brought growth, and a lot of change. And the pastor wrote a clergy column in the local paper, the Williston Herald, saying, let's not fear the newcomer, let's welcome them. And I read that article in the paper, and I was looking to understand the story of the boom in North Dakota, and something about his sentiment struck me, and I called him, and he said, you've got to come here and see what's happening. And the moment I set foot in his church and met some of these men and saw the raw desperation in their faces, they were crying, they'd left their homes and their families behind, and his connection with them was extraordinarily powerful, and he was a really complicated person. And I said, I don't know what the story is here, but I'm going to start filming. And I spent the first 6 months of production sleeping in the church with the men, and that was really the way into to the story, into my relationship with Pastor Jay, who's the main character.
Do you regularly read small town North Dakota newspapers?
You know, it's great when you're trying to understand a local story to not rely on the national news, because the national news story about the boom was like, it's easy opportunity, it's easy six-figure jobs. And the reality for people on the ground is so much different. It's so hard to survive there. And I think that story wasn't being told. And I felt like, you know, the work that inspires me, like Harlan County, USA, is really
Barbara
intimate. Barbara Koppel's film. It's really intimate, ground level storytelling, and to over time that shows what the experience is. And I wanted to try to do that here, and to say, you know, is there a different story to be told here about the boom in North Dakota?
It raises a point about journalism and the role of the documentary filmmaker can play in bringing a different perspective to a story, a different angle, approaching, again, a national story on this same issue might have looked at the oil company, or it might have looked at a bunch of different things. You've had films here before at Sundance. Tell me about sort of you mentioned Harlan County, but tell me about sort of what documentary filmmaking means to you, or why it's an important way to explore a story, and you've written about documentary for IndieWire, but now you're a filmmaker.
Well, the films that really move me and that inspire me are films that maybe take a big story or a complex political or economic story, social story, but find a personal way in and find the human drama and the emotion in those stories and take us on a journey. And that's what I wanted to try to do here. And I think that, you know, the boom in North Dakota, it's like the Iraq War. There's so many ways in and so many different stories to tell. But what was compelling about the Overnighters program and the pastor was that here was one character who was kind of in the fulcrum, in the pinch point, if you will, of this influx of men, these thousands of men, and the local community who was fearing the newcomers. And like, he was right in the middle of those forces. And I thought, he's got a lot of pressure on him, but this is a prism to look at a bigger story, but on a human level. And that's what I think documentary can do, and it can follow characters over a long period of time, in this case 2 years, to say, how did their lives change?
Tell us a bit more about this pastor. You mentioned him, and after you tell us about the pastor, and my follow-up question will be, tell me a little bit more about how you gained his trust to be able to tell this story.
Well, the pastor, what struck me, he's a Lutheran pastor, and to him, this was the Christian ethic, to love your neighbor. Mm-hmm. But what does that really mean? And we think of that as being an easy, moral religious imperative, help people in need. But the truth is, those are never easy choices. And I saw him making what I thought was not just a religious choice, a choice of living the Christian life as he saw it, but really to be a man of conscience. But it's not an easy choice, because when he decides to help these men, and some of them have criminal records, they're desperate, they bring their problems with them. When he helps them, the community gets fearful. His neighbors are concerned. His family is also concerned about his investment in them. And over the course of the film, he gets more and more involved in their lives and their problems. And it kind of draws him into this maelstrom. But I saw a man really struggling with what I think is a universal question that we all struggle with, which is, you know, we live in a country of great social inequality, and how do we help people who need help? And those choices are not simple choices.
Jesse Moss is a filmmaker based in San Francisco. His previous films include Speedo, A Demolition Derby Love Story, as well as Con Man. And you had a film here a few years ago, William Kunstler, Disturbing the Universe.
As a producer.
What are you working on next?
You know, I'm so focused on this film and Sundance and hopefully having a great conversation around Pastor Jay and the Overnighters program. It's hard to think further than, like, you know, the hand in front of my face. One thing I wanted to quickly say about the pastor is that, you know, he himself he's a very surprising character, and the film has a twist and a turn that I never expected, which really unlocked a kind of mystery to his character.
You must be an old pro coming back to Sundance. It must be easy, right?
It's not easy at all, and it feels like I've kind of stepped onto the other side of the curtain, so to speak, as a director, and to have my own work here. I came as a producer with a film I was very, very invested in and
the
attached
Kunstler.
To, the Kunstler film, but it's really different to have my own work on screen and really to feel a lot of excitement and pressure. It feels totally different, actually. It feels like something I'm not prepared for. And we got our premiere today. I have the pastor. As of last night, he decided to fly in for the premiere, so it's been touch and go, but he's going to be here, and that's really exciting for me, and I can't wait to, you know, to talk to the audience about the film.
The film is called The Overnighters. The director is Jesse Moss. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Eugene. It's great to be here.
As we continue on the Daily Buzz from the 2014 Sundance Film Festival, Joe Berlinger is here. Welcome,
hey,
Joe.
Nice to see you again, Eugene.
No stranger to Sundance.
No, I'm embarrassed and proud to say this is my sixth premiere here.
Don't be embarrassed at all.
No, I feel like Sundance is too good to me. It's been great.
You were on the show a couple years ago talking about the Graceland documentary, a terrific documentary.
Yeah, thanks.
You're back this year with Whitey, the United States of America versus James J. Bulger.
Bulger, yeah. It was an endeavor.
He's a fascinating guy. You're working with CNN Films.
Yeah,
fascinating guy. I was able to watch the film before the festival. For folks who are listening in, both locally here and, you know, making a decision about what to see while they're here and listening in on KCPW here in Salt Lake, and for folks that are listening around the country, tell us a bit about who this guy is.
Yeah,
he's a notorious figure, but people may not always necessarily know who.
Well, you know, Whitey Bulger is one of the most notorious criminals, certainly the most notorious criminal in the history of Boston, and no criminal in the modern day culture has the guy's got a first name basis, Whitey. You know, people know him as Whitey. So he has really been a legend in the popular culture. Dozens of books cram the shelves. The Jack Nicholson portrayal in The Departed was based on the Whitey character.
And yet he's famous for being infamous, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, he ran Boston's underworld for close to three decades and was not prosecuted even for a misdemeanor. I mean, the guy was like Teflon Don.
The original Teflon.
The original Teflon Don. And there's a lot of legend and myth that swirls around him. How was he allowed to get away with all of this murder and mayhem? And some people believe, and it's been widely reported, that he was an FBI informant. And this film goes into that detail. And while I don't purport to have the definitive answer, there's a lot of evidence to show that the conspiracy and the corruption goes much deeper, that he was actually not an FBI informant, that he was given a free pass for other reasons, other more sinister reasons, payoffs and falsified affidavits in the government's attempt to bring down the mob. So the fact that he was finally brought to trial, here's a guy who ruled the criminal underworld for three decades, and then finally a new generation of prosecutors wanted to indict him because he was just the FBI knew he was killing people while he was an FBI informant, or maybe he wasn't an FBI informant, but they knew he was killing people, and yet they never prosecuted him. A new generation of prosecutors came in, pursued an indictment. He was then tipped off by the FBI, and he fled for 16 years. And even though he was number two on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, no one believes that the FBI really actually was looking for him until a new generation of FBI guys came in and said, hey, enough is enough. And finally, he was apprehended in Santa Monica in 2011, living in plain sight.
Yeah,
I mean, it was not much of an effort, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many, to actually to capture this guy. So when he was finally brought to trial, which nobody thought was ever going to happen, in Boston this summer, the biggest legal proceeding since the 1920s in Massachusetts, since the Sacco and Vanzetti trial, you could say, mm-hmm. biggest legal proceeding that everyone was anticipating was going to finally shed some light on all of the alleged corruption, mm-hmm. all of the alleged payoffs in mm-hmm. Boston Police, Massachusetts State Police, the FBI. Why was this guy allowed to kill with impunity? And unfortunately, the trial for many, even though it was like the casting call of the greatest gangsters and it was great theater, it was a very unsatisfying trial. Obviously, this guy was going to be convicted. There was no way he was going to get away, prevail in this trial. It was a 33-count murder and racketeering indictment. And the government, however, greatly narrowed the scope of his defense, would not allow him to testify about certain things. And this was precisely what everybody wanted to hear, was this level of corruption, how high it went to Washington and the Department of Justice and the FBI, and he was not allowed to testify to these things. And so that's when this film really became, you know, a mission for me. Basically, I view this film as the trial that Whitey never got, or the defense that Whitey was never allowed to give. Mm-hmm. And this is in no way, we're not making an apology for Whitey or taking his side. He was a brutal, vicious killer who did horrendous things and deserves to be in prison. But he was enabled by the federal government. And that level of corruption has yet to have been exposed. And the goal of the film is to provoke all those questions and to get a little more accountability than has been gotten to date.
Our guest on the Daily Buzz is Joe Berlinger. We're talking about his new film, Whitey, a documentary playing here at Sundance 2014. As I mentioned at the beginning, you're no stranger to this festival. I think I became aware of your work through Brothers Keeper, which played here in the 90s, and later with the Paradise Lost films, and more recently with Under African Skies. We had you on the show talking about that. You mentioned at the beginning the fact that there's this like kind of legend and myth of this character.
Yeah.
So as a filmmaker, taking a step back from this particular film, but as a filmmaker, what intrigues you enough about a subject to want to spend the months and years it's going to take to tell a story? It seems like that core kind of legend myth aspect is a very intriguing component for any documentary filmmaker. But what kind of drives Joe Berlinger, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at.
Well, as usual, Eugene, you ask excellent questions. That is an excellent question. You know, for me, I look for stories that, you know, some individual situation sheds some universal truth. So I'm always looking for ways to blow up stereotypes and to demonstrate that the media often presents things in black and white, and the reality is things are much more nuanced. You know, Paradise Lost, the three guys, the media basically crucified these guys as devil worshiping, you know, heavy, you listen to heavy metal, you must be a devil worshiper, and, you know, therefore you're guilty of these three horrible murders. The reality was very different. And so I looked to explode kind of stereotypes. Brothers Keeper, same deal. Mm-hmm. People thought that these guys were guilty because they were smelly old farmers who didn't change their clothes, but they were some of the most lovely human beings that I've ever met in my life. With the Whitey case, I've never seen somebody who has so much legend swirling about him, who people have written books without actually having ever talked to him. And in fact, one of the most, I think, important aspects of my film is we have an interview with Whitey. This is the first time in the history of Whitey Bulger that he has actually spoken for himself. People have allowed themselves to speak for whiteys, calling him an informant, calling him a killer of women, accusing him of this crime and that crime. But nobody's really ever talked to the guy. And one of the things I'm most proud of in this film is we were actually able to get him while incarcerated to speak for the film. And he has, again, we're not making an apology for Whitey. He's a, as I said, a brutal, vicious killer. But he has a lot to say about government corruption and what allowed him to reign over a criminal empire for 25 years. And so what interests me is, how is a narrative spun? How do people tell stories? Even a film, as a documentarian, I've always believed that films are inherently subjective, and any documentarian who tells you that they're presenting the objective truth about anything is kidding themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, every decision you make in making a film is very subjective, from the hundreds of hours of footage you leave on the cutting room floor. Well, I guess not in the old days on Brother's Keeper, we left it on the cutting room floor. Now in that bin on the computer, the angles you choose, we all know that filmmaking is inherently subjective. So I'm not saying we're presenting the truth of Whitey Bulger in this case, but we're allowing him to speak for himself. And in many ways, I think the Whitey film, for people who are interested in film aesthetics, is very much about how do we spin a legend in our time. And there are all sorts of legends and myths about this guy, and half of them just aren't true. And I guess that's what preoccupies me, is what is the truth? Because I think even a documentarian who tells you he's presenting you the truth of a situation is kidding himself.
What we think we know about Whitey is complicated by this film in a good way. What happens next?
Debut to Berlinger or to Whitey?
To what happens to this film next?
It was made for CNN Films. I'm proud to be part of their inaugural slate. I hope it's well received here. I hope someone thinks it's worthy of theatrical distribution, but it'll eventually go on CNN in the probably spring or summer.
Well, we're wrapping up our conversation with Joe Berlinger. The film is called Whitey, the United States of America versus James J. Bulger. Congratulations on being back at Sundance.
Thank you.
Once again.
And good to see you again.
Good to see you.
Thanks.
Continuing on the Daily Buzz at the Sundance Film Festival from Main Street, and I've been really looking forward to this conversation. Talking about a film, a documentary playing here at Sundance called Cesar's Last Fast. Welcome, Richard Ray Perez.
Great, thanks. It's good to be here.
Your name tag says Rick, so can we call you Rick?
Yeah, my nickname's Rick. You can call me Rick.
All right, so very good. I would guess that, I would hope that most of the people listening in to the Daily Buzz today know who Cesar Chavez is. So we're going to assume that for a moment.
Sure.
But as we kind of go through this conversation, we'll talk more about him, and people will probably learn, just as with the film, things about him they might not have known. But maybe as a way of starting the conversation, the film is being introduced to the world here at Sundance. Give us a sense of why Cesar's story was interesting to you, why you wanted to tell this story, I guess.
Sure. I mean, I have a very close personal connection to Cesar's story. It's related to both my family history. My dad and his extended family were farm workers, and I grew up in a neighborhood that was very actively involved and immersed in that movement in the early 70s.
Where'd you grow up?
In the city of San Fernando, which is the northeast San Fernando Valley. So as a child, that era was very vibrant politically and very inspiring. Mm-hmm. And then years later, I developed a fascinating, I would describe it as almost a karmic relationship with a filmmaker named Lorena Parlee, who had started a film about Cesar. And ultimately, I inherited the project that she had started.
She passed away in 2006.
Correct.
Tell me about the relationship with her and the conversations that you had before she passed away. Sadly, she died. She had an extended battle with breast cancer. But tell the audience about some of those early conversations you had with her, and then how you sort of carried out the project going forward.
Sure. Lorena heard that I was interested in doing a project, and she had already started a project.
Right.
She had amassed 85 hours of Chavez-related footage, and including about 20 hours that had never been seen by the public. She had been Cesar's press secretary during the late 80s. Mm-hmm. So she'd been working on a project. She heard I was working on a project. She gave me a call. And she said, hey, you know, I've been working on this project for 10 years. I knew Caesar. I have all this footage. I've been struggling to finish this film. I'm a team of one. Some people asked about, you know, coming onto the project, people I knew. And I told her that I didn't think they were right for the project. She really appreciated that. Then she went on and asked me if I would join her team of one, essentially, to come on board with the mm-hmm. project. Mm-hmm. At the time, I just gotten my first director for hire job. I said, I can't do this. I'm tied up for the next 6 months. Mm-hmm. And she told me, well, I need somebody to help me now because I'm being treated for breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And I could only work on the film for 2 weeks out of the month. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of startled. And I said, well, you know, in 6 months, when I'm done with this job, if you haven't heard from somebody, call me and I'll join the team. Mm-hmm. And 6 months later, I didn't hear from her. I assume she found some collaborators. 9 months later, I get a phone call from a gentleman who says, hi, I'm Lorena Parley's stepfather. Lorena died last month of breast cancer. And she left her name in her notes for us to contact you immediately to see if you would finish your film.
Wow.
Do you want to finish your film? And so at that, what do you say? And at that point, it became sort of a mission and a cause.
And that was over 7 years ago.
Yes. So I got that phone call. It would have been the fall of 2007. Mm. Yes. They said, you know, her parents and I became friends. They said, all the footage is here in our garage. Come and take a look at it. Mm-hmm. And after we negotiated a sort of a legal agreement, I looked at all the footage. And I saw a film that was different than the film Lorena had started. Mm-hmm. I saw a film that was much more structured around his spiritual commitment, mm-hmm. Specifically around footage that Lorena had collected of a fast Caesar undertook in 88. And that eventually became the film Caesar's Last Fast.
Yep. So you talked a moment ago about the personal connection you feel with Cesar Chavez, with the issues he advocated for, and you talked about your growing up. Can you elaborate a bit on that and talk about some of the sort of, maybe draw a stronger link to growing up in California, and tell us maybe a little bit about sort of any thoughts, connections, sort of relationships you feel that sort of tie you back to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Time.
You know, in 1969, I was 4 years old. I was in a preschool program, and there were these university students who'd come and volunteer. And one day, a university student came and volunteered. He sat down with my colleagues, my classmates, preschool classmates, and we were having lunch. And when it was time to eat our dessert that was part of this lunch, it was this horrible fruit cocktail and heavy syrup. Yeah. I noticed that he started plucking the grapes out of his fruit cocktail. And I was really curious, and I said, oh, how come you're plucking the grapes out of the fruit cocktail? And he said, well, because the people who own the grape fields, they treat the people who pick the grapes terribly. They pay them miserably. They humiliate them. They make them live in shacks. And if these people complain, they fire them. And I can't eat these grapes because of that. Mm-hmm. And I looked down at my grapes, and they become disgusting. And I couldn't eat them either. Mm-hmm. So I started plucking the grapes out of my fruit cocktail. And pretty soon, all the other preschool kids in the class at the desk started plucking their grapes out. And we couldn't eat those grapes for the rest of the year and for the rest of the time that we were in elementary school. It was a profound experience. And then I later learned that my dad, you know, before I was born, was picking grapes. And at that time, my aunts and uncles were still picking grapes.
Likewise.
And that there was a national boycott that was ended up being the most successful consumer boycott in the country. And it was led by a man named Cesar Chavez. So it was a very profound experience that happened to me when I was 4 years old, a very learning experience that I was later able to contextualize.
Powerful story. For those who are listening in and will hear about this film and hopefully have a chance to see it after Sundance somewhere, let's talk about Caesar's Last Fast.
Sure.
Tell us about his Last Fast and tell us about, for those who haven't seen the film yet, what you feel the impact of that Last Fast was.
Sure. So in 1988, Cesar Chavez was 61 years old at the time. In the late 80s, pesticides were loosely regulated in California and around the country. And what emerged was there were a few cancer clusters that emerged in farm worker communities in Central California. At that time, the United Farm Workers, the organization that Cesar Chavez has founded, had lost a lot of their power. And then farm worker children were being born with cancer. So as a both an act of penance and an act of protest, if you will, Caesar stopped eating. And nobody knew how long it will how long he would go before he'd eat again. And every day of that fast, which ultimately lasted 36 days, he was growing weaker and weaker, mm-hmm. and the family was becoming more and more concerned. The doctors were coming in to try to talk him into breaking the fast. The family would come in to try to talk him to break into breaking the fast. And Lorena Parlee started shooting all this intimate behind-the-scene footage, just watching him grow weaker and weaker. Well, that film, that fast becomes the architecture around which we tell Caesar's entire story. The amazing things that he did, which is an overlooked story in our, you know, in our nation's narrative. So we
and it was a 36 day.
It was ultimately a 36
fast,
day
water
fast.
Only. He's only water drinking only. Water.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately, when they when he broke the fast, he was so weak he had to be carried into a mass that 7,000 people attended. He was carried in by his sons, and at the right moment, a priest brings a piece of bread, gives it to Ethel Kennedy. He would come for that event. And she gives Caesar a piece of bread, and he has his first food in 36 days, and the crowd goes crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hugely powerful and emotional moment. I mm-hmm. think that people, there are few times in American history do we get to witness that type of commitment. And so it's a amazing and profound way to tell Caesar's story.
It's a powerful story and a powerful film. In the 2 minutes we have left, tell us what you feel Cesar Chavez's sort of lasting impact is. What is the impact of his work on the same issues today? And the other side of that question is, what do you hope the impact of this film, that the impact of this film will be?
Sure. I mean, there was the immediate impact in terms that he really transformed how farm workers live and work, particularly in the Southwest. After his work, you know, now if there are bathrooms in the fields, there are water, there are all these laws to protect them. I think on a larger level, he empowered a generation of Latinos to realize that they have the power to organize and that they have a place in this nation's history and that they can fight for social justice. He showed that successfully. I think what the film can tell us today is that there's a new generation of primarily Latino immigrants who don't know this history. And we want to introduce that model to empower them so that they can see that they can rally together, organize around issues like low income, around living wage, around raising the minimum wage, and around just social justice issues for all Americans. When we see the growing income disparity and the growing income gap in this country, I think this is a story that relates to today, what we can do to ensure that we're treated fairly economically. And I think it's vital for today, and I think it has a profound message for today.
Richard Ray Perez is the director of Caesar's Last Fast, debuting here at the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. Congratulations on the film.
Thanks, Eugene.
Best wishes with it as it heads out into the world.
Thanks.
And thank you for being on The Daily Buzz.
Thank you.
And as we wrap up this second edition of The Daily Buzz, it's time for our Industry Insider segment. We have someone at the table who is sort of defines the word industry insider as far as this festival is concerned, as far as I'm concerned in particular. And his name is Ira Deutschman. Welcome, Ira.
Thank you. Welcome.
With a company, with a couple of institutions, Emerging Pictures, which is a company that you created, founded. We'll talk about that in a minute. You also represent Columbia University, where you're the dean.
The chair.
The chair.
Yes.
Of the film program. I want to go back and talk about the festival's history, because your relationship with a particular film at this festival in 1989 really, I think, defines or marks a particular important moment in this festival's history. This festival's, we were talking earlier in the show with in the Hot Topics segment about the business side of the festival a little bit and acquisitions and all of this. But before Sex, Lies, and Videotape in 1989, there was no real marketplace at Sundance. That's, or that was really, if there was one, it was probably very casual and subtle and quiet. Sex, Lies, and Videotape really announced this festival as a different kind of festival for this country.
I mean, it changed the profile of the types of buyers who came to the festival, because suddenly there was something that had broken through commercially in a bigger way than it had happened ever before then. Before Sex, Lies, and Videotape, this was a tiny little sleepy town. I mean, I guess you could say that Steven Soderbergh was responsible for the first traffic light in Park City, because there literally were none in the town before then. But yeah, it was after that film went on to win the grand prize at Cannes and ended up with a $20+ million gross, that suddenly this became a marketplace where everybody felt like they needed to be here. And even then, it took several years before there was actually a film ever sold here. Mm-hmm. It just, all that meant was that suddenly it was on everybody's map.
And that was 93 or 94, I believe, when films actually started selling here during the festival.
Correct.
So deals would happen, films would play here, maybe from 89 to 93, 94, right? But the deals would happen sort of after the fact?
Yeah. I mean, the conversations would start here, and then the negotiations would begin. And if you think about where it is on the calendar, there were a number of instances where things would sell out of new directors in New York or, you know, later on in Cannes, but films that had premiered at Sundance. But no deals would ever get made here. And in fact, it became a mission on the part of certain sales agents to try to make sure that they could be the first sales agent to sell a film at Sundance. And there was a competition going on, but it took a while for it to happen.
So who has that that dubious distinction?
I think John Pearson claims that it was him. Sometimes you really don't know whether the deal was really made at Sundance or not, or whether it was announced here.
A little bit of orchestration for media attention that happens, especially now.
Yeah, exactly.
There were deals announced yesterday for films that hadn't even
screened
yet.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But clearly, even with that in mind, just the imprimatur of Sundance having been accepted whatever, a month and a half ago, mm-hmm. Sets the film on its course.
And yeah, whereas back before Sex Lies, nobody would have cared.
They didn't pay attention until the film played, and then it kind of
That's
went
right.
from there. Flash forward to 2014, and Manola Dargis wrote a piece in the New York Times recently that was almost like not only a cry for help on her part, but a message to the industry saying, stop buying so many movies. You're all going to go to Sundance and see all these movies, but there's too many films out there. Critics can't review all of them. Audiences can't process all of them. So maybe you're in a unique position to not only reflect on where this business started at this festival in 89, but flash forward to 2014 and you have the lead critic for the New York Times sort of saying, stop, this is too much. What do you think? How do you respond to that piece?
First of all, I completely agree with Manola on the basic level of the point that she's trying to make. But I think that there was one little piece that was missing from her explanation of it for people who aren't familiar with the marketplace. What she really was saying is that there's too many films flooding the theatrical marketplace. She's not saying don't buy the movies, and she's not saying that there aren't worthy movies that are being shown that deserve some sort of an audience. But theatrical is a particular animal that requires a certain amount of real support to get people interested in seeing it. And when you have hundreds of movies that are flooding the theatrical market, it's not good for anybody. Mm. The question is who's making those decisions as to which ones are worthy and which ones are not. And the problem is that some of the people who are making those decisions are making them for completely cynical reasons that have nothing to do with whether those films really have theatrical potential or not. And so it puts the Times in an awkward position because they have this amazing commitment that I don't think they should give up on to review every film that is released in New York theatrically. Without that, it would be really, really difficult to get attention for anything. So, you know, I mean, she's caught in a really interesting place. If the film's main source of revenue is going to end up being in the downstream marketplace, you know, if it's going to be online or on VOD or whatever, using theatrical as simply a platform to get attention to actually make the money down the road.
A marketing hook.
Exactly. Just to get the New York Times review, which is actually what many of them are doing, that to me is a real negative.
Where do you think it goes? Where do you think we are in a year, 2 years, 3 years? There certainly won't be a shortage of movies being made. Putting on your other hat as the chair of Columbia University, you're training the next generation of filmmakers.
Okay, well, there's three questions to that question, but
I want to see where you take it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's start with the Columbia side of it, which is that we're trying really hard to make sure that the students are not completely hooked on this idea that theatrical is the only way to see the work that they create. We're trying to make sure that they're completely conversant in all of the various platforms that exist, and we're encouraging them to experiment with narrative in ways in which they take advantage of the inherent strengths of those other ways of releasing films. So there is a bit of the education that has to do with understanding the marketplace and the way in which the marketplace in effect affects the narrative. But, you know, aside from that, I'm a big believer in the fact that we have to hit a point where people are going to begin to understand that there's a uniqueness to every way in which people consume media, and that it sometimes takes time to figure out what that means. So we're in this in-between stage right now that I hope doesn't end up becoming the death knell for instance, the Times policy, because just because it's not working right this second is no reason for them to start treating movies the way that they already have with book reviews and other things where they're being selective about what they'll review, because then, you know, there's literally is no way to get attention for something that you know, doesn't have big stars in it or whatever. I mean, if the Times starts being selective about what they review and without creating some other structure to make that differentiation, the Times will end up looking like Entertainment Weekly.
It's interesting because when you talk about the Times, we're not just talking about, we are talking about one newspaper.
Right.
But the decisions made by the editors of the Times, what they choose to review and what they choose to devote, you know,
the little paragraphs, yeah.
One paragraph, two, yeah. Versus five or six.
I know. So to some extent, they're already making those decisions.
And that's what I want. Yeah, you know, yeah. And that, what I was about to say, is that has an impact on how other journalists, other editors at other papers, and an industry, and you know, all these other folks, it has an impact on how those movies are viewed in the marketplace beyond just the review in the New York Times. So that's why it's worth focusing on just that one part of this.
Yeah,
it's significant.
As a professional, I have to say that the one thing that bothers me about the way that the Times are doing those smaller reviews is that I wish they would just include that one little thing that gives the main credits of the movie for each of the small ones as well, because it's such a definitive thing. And by the way, if you look at it online, it's there.
Yeah.
It's just that in the newspaper, they're not putting it there anymore.
Ira Deutschman reads the newspaper?
Yeah.
I imagine you on digital, like on a tablet, in your living room, reading everything.
There's something about the way in which omelets and bacon get smudged all over the screen that actually works better with paper.
In the minute we have left, what is your focus at this year's festival? What are you, in the various capacities that you have, Columbia Emerging Pictures, what are you looking for?
It's actually a great convergence for me in the sense that first of all, we have over 50 filmmakers here that are their alums or current students from Columbia with various films that are in the festival. And so part of it is about getting the word out about that and trying to support the students and the alums as much as possible. But in my Emerging Pictures capacity, it's really about shaking hands and kissing babies and that kind of stuff.
The campaign continues.
Yeah.
We'll let you get back to it. Ira Deutschman on The Daily Buzz. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eugene.
And we're wrapping up this second edition of The Daily Buzz of the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. The show is produced by the Film Society of Lincoln Center and our producer, Irene Cho. Sponsored by Soyombo Vodka, Sabra Hummus, Skull Candy, and Cloud Electronics. Our in-kind sponsors are Super Good Bars, All Good Provisions, and People Water, coming to you today from the Million Square Foot Lounge, Microsoft's lounge, on Main Street. This is The Daily Buzz on KCPW.